Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and this is another episode of the Weekly Docket where I recap the headlines in true crime for the week. You've probably noticed that I haven't issued a deep dive recently. There is reason for that. We are in the midst of moving, and I am, of course, handling the brunt of that when it comes to packing and just coordinating everything. Moving is just so stressful. I know you guys understand, so I don't even have to keep going on about it. We can just go ahead and dive into today's weekly docket. I've got a bunch of stories prepared for you guys. And if you will remember, on Facebook, I have a page called True Crime Kelly, and I post tons of stories throughout the week, usually multiple stories every day. And anytime I get engagement on those, I'm looking at the comments, I'm kind of scanning the top ones, especially the ones that have a lot of likes, if there's like over 1,000. But anyway, I want to start including those comments. And so I want it to be like kind of conversational. I want to hear your guys' input on these stories. And just see how that goes. So we're trying out something new, and so far I think it's going pretty well. There's been some funny comments, some really good, thoughtful comments, and so I'm eager to include those in these stories today. So without further ado, let's get started. First story comes out of Colorado, where on March 19th, Tara Johnson Schwartz, who is 45 years old, was sentenced to 14 years in prison, first for having an inappropriate relationship with a student, and then also continuing to contact him after the court specifically told her not to. The victim confirmed those attempts, and according to the arrest affidavit in the second case, in an interview, the student said his former teacher walked up to him at a concert and said, "Just say you don't love me." Yeah, this woman is 45 years old and the student was only 16. And this all started back in 2024 when the student was, like I said, only 16, but allegedly she began texting and exchanging playlists, like music playlists, with this student as she groomed him. And then later she started bringing him cigarettes and let him use her marijuana vape pen before they eventually had sex, according to the police. Now, it was brought to the attention of police in January of 2025 when a therapist, presumably for the student, reported it to authorities. Less than a month later, on February 18th of 2025, the student was captured on surveillance leaving the school and getting into Tara's car. 5 months prior to that, Tara was recognized as one of 7 finalists for the Colorado Teacher of the Year. Then over the subsequent 4th of July weekend, there was this concert, and she showed up to this concert because she knew the student was going to be there. This band that was playing at the concert was one of the bands that they would exchange music playlists with, like early on in their text exchanges. And he later told authorities, quote, "Yeah, it was really weird. I was going there expecting to have a really great time. And then I just see her in front of the line, like 30 feet up. Yeah, it was weird." End quote. Reminder, this guy's 16. But anyway, the 23rd Judicial District Attorney, George Brockler, stated in a press release after Tara's sentence, saying, quote, "This warning is coming from a DA and a parent. If a teacher in our community exploits their position of trust with our kids for their own lascivious desires, we will seek to change their life forever. We will work to make them a convicted felon, and we will try to take away their freedom." Here, this predator stated at her sentencing that this conduct will not define who she is. "I disagree. She is now a convicted sex offender and will live with that label for decades. For those keeping track, this marks the 4th teacher convicted of a felony sex offense by our office since we came into existence last year. So far, all have been incarcerated." End quote. Honestly, I love this DA. I love hearing somebody actually crack down on this ridiculous behavior that we see literally on a weekly basis at this point. You know, I remember back in like the 90s when Mary Kay Letourneau became a huge scandal because she was this teacher who had an affair with her young elementary school student. And it was so baffling because it was like, you just never heard of that happening. Now it's like every week there's another story of another teacher having these inappropriate relationships. What in the world is wrong with these freaking teachers? Last week we had a story based on a school district that had a school, actually, not even a district, a school building that had two teachers arrested within the same week on separate offenses. That is asinine. How does this keep happening? I guess you could make the argument that it keeps happening because a lot of DAs will, or gosh, let me back up, actually. A lot of school districts will reassign a teacher to a different, either a different building or different district, rather than go through the process of actually firing them because it makes them look bad. Almost always, it comes down to authorities getting involved and not actually the schools, which is really disheartening. Anyway, we're going to move on to the next story. If you have a difference of opinion on that or you want to enlighten me, please message me. You can either leave it on a comment on this episode if you're listening on Spotify, or you can go to mamamystery.com and leave me a message in that white box at the bottom of the screen. Now, our next story is out of Tipp City, Ohio. We've talked about this one before, but a trial date has officially been set for a former American Idol contestant who was accused of killing his wife inside their home and then falsifying a burglary gone wrong. So you might remember, this is Caleb Flynn. He's 39 years old. I'm going to put him on the cover art of this week's episode. You'll probably recognize him. But he appeared in court this week where a judge scheduled his trial to begin on April 28th. He has pleaded not guilty to multiple charges, including murder and tampering with evidence in connection with the death of his wife, Ashley Flynn, who was only 37 years old. Now, this case goes back to February 16th of this year, so not that long ago, which is why I'm kind of shocked that the trial is already scheduled to happen literally this month. But anyway, police were called to the couple's home in Tipp City after Caleb made a frantic 911 call claiming that there was a burglary in progress. He told dispatchers that someone had broken in and shot his wife. When officers arrived, they found Ashley dead inside the home from multiple gunshot wounds. Their two daughters were also inside the house at the time. But as investigators began working the scene, they said that things were not lining up with Caleb's story. According to authorities, there was no evidence of a burglary, despite Caleb's claims of one. Detectives now believe that the scene was staged to make it look like a break-in and that Caleb was responsible for his wife's death. Just a few days after the incident, Caleb was arrested and later indicted on a long list of charges. Court records show he is now facing multiple counts, including aggravated murder, murder, felonious assault, and tampering with evidence. Real quick, because I know some people ask this sometimes, why is he being charged with aggravated murder and murder? And usually the reason that a prosecuting attorney or a DA will do this is because they give the jury an option of which one to convict on based on the circumstances. So if the jury believes that the circumstances of the crime fit into a certain box, whether it be aggravated murder or murder, they just have that option. So anyway, he is currently being held on a multi-million dollar bond and has remained in custody as the case moves forward. It has since come out that Caleb was allegedly having an affair with a 23-year-old worship leader at the church that he worked at, and that she may have been pregnant, which is not verified, but search warrant affidavits reviewed by local media revealed heavy and extensive communication between Caleb Flynn and an unidentified woman in the hours before the shooting. Investigators are reportedly focusing on a message that was sent from Caleb's phone at 12:42 a.m., roughly 2 hours before the murder, that read, "It's almost done." Caleb, who once appeared on season 12 of American Idol, has largely stayed quiet in court proceedings. During his most recent appearance, he did not speak as the judge set the timeline for trial. Ashley, meanwhile, has been described as a dedicated mother, an involved substitute teacher, and a volleyball coach who was very active in her community. Now, as for the comments on this story, the top one is from Missy May, and it says, quote, "Man, he looks so sad. Maybe they should let him out." And then in all caps, "Street justice." And I just really liked that comment because honestly, yeah, I get that. Because sometimes I think they're almost better off in the public to let the public handle them. But I think he's, you know, he's where he needs to be. I'll give it that. Okay. The next story comes out of White Bear Lake, Minnesota, where an NHL reporter, Jessie Pierce, and her three children were killed in a devastating house fire. So this all took place in a quiet Minnesota neighborhood. And this, like I said, is regarding the NHL reporter, Jessie Pierce, who was only 38 years old, and her three children, Hudson, Caden, and Avery. Now, the fire broke out early Saturday morning, and by the time first responders arrived, the scene was already overwhelming. Officers reported seeing flames shooting dozens of feet into the air from down the street. And when they finally reached the home, it was fully engulfed. Firefighters immediately tried to get inside, but the conditions were so intense that they were initially unable to enter the home. The flames and the heat at the front entry point prevented any immediate rescue attempt, forcing crews to fight the fire from outside before they could safely move in. Around that same time, police were able to reach Jessie's husband, Mike Henricks, by phone, and he was out of town for work and preparing to board a flight back to Minnesota when he got the call. He confirmed to authorities that his wife and children should have been inside the home. Once firefighters were finally able to get the fire under control and enter the house, they made the devastating discovery. Jessie and her three children were found together near the front of the home, close to the entryway. They were likely in the midst of trying to escape. And their family dog was also found deceased inside. Investigators now believe the fire moved extremely fast, cutting off any chance of escape. The fact that all four were found near the front is just, it's gut-wrenching. I hate to think of what this family, this mother and her children, went through. Now, Jessie Pierce, whose legal name was Jessie Henricks, has spent years covering the Minnesota Wild and was well known in the hockey community. In the days since the fire, tributes have poured in from across the NHL, local teams, and fans who followed her work. Her husband released a statement describing the loss as unthinkable, saying that the family has lost a beautiful wife, daughter, sister, and friend, along with three children who were the light of their lives. As for what caused the fire, investigators are still working to figure that out. Early findings indicate no evidence of arson, but authorities are taking a wide approach and examining everything from electrical systems and appliances to candles, heating sources, battery-operated devices, and even gas lines. Now, because of how destructive the fire was, determining the exact cause may take time. Officials are also waiting on autopsy and toxicology reports, which could help clarify how quickly the fire spread and what exactly the victims may have experienced. I think what they mean by that is like how much soot might be found in their lungs to determine, you know, how long they were experiencing this, I guess. Rachel West commented on this story saying this is sad beyond belief, but also very strange. And the reason I chose Rachel's comment is because I saw a lot of comments like this that were kind of suggesting that something might be fishy here. Like, obviously we're waiting on more answers, but you know, to think that I think a lot of people in the comment section, I'm not saying Rachel, but some people were commenting that, you know, maybe, or do we know when the husband left? Like everyone's kind of looking at the husband. And I get that, you know, in a true crime community, it's very easy to kind of jump to conclusions, but I really want to push pause on that or pump the brakes on that because this is a really devastating story. And if this husband truly had absolutely nothing to do with it and was truly just boarding a plane on the way home, having no idea what just happened to his family, that is really impossible to fathom. And I think Wendy Lilly says it best with her comment. She wrote, quote, "That poor husband, boarding a flight, not knowing what he was going back to and having to think about it and worry the whole way home. So sad. I have been thinking about it since this happened. Such a tragedy," end quote. Now for the next story, we're going to kind of circle back to one that we talked about last week, which is of course the Taylor Frankie Paul and Dakota Mortensen of it all. Now last week I left off where I had watched, I think like a third or half of the body cam footage, the whole hour and a half long video. And I did go ahead and finish it. Now, I want to preface my opinion by saying that I don't really watch Secret Lives of Mormon Wives. I watched like the first one or two seasons, I believe. I watched some of season three. This is like back when it had all come out, so I kind of have forgotten some of it. So anyway, all of that is to say, I have not watched season four or five, if five is out. But I'm trying to understand why people hate Dakota Mortensen so much. So I watched the video, like I said, and in the context of that night, okay, in the context of that specific night in 2023, Taylor Frankie Paul was completely in the wrong. Her alleging that he pushed her in the garage is what a lot of people are kind of grasping at. And I do believe he probably put her in the garage or locked her in or shoved her into the garage, however you want to phrase it. I believe he probably did that because she was attacking him. And I believe that he was trying to keep her in the garage because look at what she did inside of the house. She completely trashed the place. She launched multiple bar stools at Dakota, one of which hit her own daughter. And this is confirmed by the daughter's biological father in a later phone call when he confirms that the little girl did have a goose egg on her head. Now, in the footage of that night, Taylor is clearly the aggressor. Dakota doesn't even want her to face consequences. He's crying. He's upset. Doesn't even want her to fill out the police. He doesn't want to fill out the police report. And he's asking if he can get arrested instead. And when her children are brought up, Taylor doesn't even ask a single question about them, if they're okay, literally anything. But Dakota's repeatedly asking about the children. And she doesn't seem to be concerned. I mean, obviously she's very drunk, but she's not concerned in that moment that this happened in front of one of her children. In fact, when her mom confronts her in the police vehicle, she says, "Do not, whatever you do, do not contact Dakota or you will lose your kids. You will get in more and more trouble." And Taylor responds, "Can I please just go talk to him?" And this is at minute 54 in the body cam footage. It's kind of hard to hear. Otherwise, I would just play it for you, but it's kind of muffled. And I think it's just better if you watch it for yourself. But I keep seeing people compare this situation to the Gabby Petito case. And I just have to say, I believe that that's unfair. In my opinion, it's disrespectful to Gabby and her family because this is clearly a very different situation. Now, if we go back to Gabby and Brian, there is police body cam footage of them getting pulled over because there was a confrontation in a parking lot where allegedly a witness saw Gabby scratch Brian. And in the midst of it, like with the context, I guess Brian wasn't letting Gabby in the van or something to that effect. I might even be mischaracterizing this, but the point is, they eventually got pulled over, and after interviewing Gabby and Brian, the police determined that Gabby was the aggressor in that situation. But what followed after that point is very, very different from Taylor and Dakota's situation, because when the police offered to just separate Gabby and Brian, they didn't make an arrest, but they did just encourage them to separate for the night. They sent Brian to a hotel and literally booked a room for him at a hotel. And then they sent Gabby to a rest stop, essentially, like a campground where she could just shower there and spend the night in the van, I guess. But the response was very different. Brian never tried to stick up for Gabby, never tried to say, "Oh, this was actually my fault." Like, he just really gleaned on the sense that he was a victim and refused to take any ownership in this at all. And then we know, soon after that event, Brian ended up killing Gabby. And that story is heartbreaking and devastating. And I think to compare that story to this story is kind of like comparing oranges and apples. There might be some similarities, but at the root of it, this is a very different situation. If the roles were switched here and Dakota was launching metal bar stools at Taylor, this would be an entirely different conversation. And that double standard is part of the reason why I believe we have cases like Shayna Hubers or Jodi Arias and Dahlia DiPolito, Pam Hupp, Stacey Castor, like women that I have showcased on this podcast and in my book, Wicked Women. I could go on with examples. Now, at the root of this, Dakota and Taylor are obviously very toxic for each other. That much is painfully clear. But I just don't understand why people are defending Taylor so much while simultaneously trashing and bashing Dakota. Now, maybe Dakota is a bad boyfriend, and that is fine. I think, you know, there's probably evidence of that, but that doesn't mean that he deserves what happened that night. There's been never any evidence that he has been physically aggressive with her. And if you think that he deserved what he got that night by having metal bar stools thrown at him when he's completely sober and she is three sheets to the wind, maybe you don't actually care about victim advocacy, and maybe you care more about a popularity contest. And here's the thing, if you want to prove me wrong, please offer examples of when Dakota was physically abusive towards Taylor so that I can have a better understanding. Because again, I don't watch this show, but I don't think it's fair to assume that we know the inner workings of a relationship based on an edited reality TV show. Now, I want to address some of the comments. This one garnered a lot of comments. So one was from Kyra Liparoto. This comment says, quote, "To be frank, no one hates Dakota because of the incident that happened in 2023. Everyone hates Dakota for literally everything else he's done since. But we all also need to keep in mind that we don't know them. We only see a very, very small amount of their lives, 99% of which is chosen to be shared. Also, for the record, I think they both need to stay far away from each other, get some therapy, and stay out of the limelight," end quote. Kyra, that is, I think, well said, and I completely agree. And I'm sure that there are a lot of examples of things that Dakota has done since this incident that portray him as a bad guy. And, you know, the thing is, I also think you have to take some of the show with a grain of salt, because these shows always try to paint someone as a villain. Otherwise, it wouldn't be interesting enough to watch. So I think you just have to keep that kind of in mind, right? The next comment was from Cheyenne Bolster, who says they're both victims in their own ways, but they're both also aggressors in their own ways. It's a really bad situation for both. Physical abuse is never okay, but neither is mental abuse. So neither is right, and both are wrong, end quote. This comment I can get on board with. I think there's, you know, probably evidence that Dakota has been maybe mentally abusive. And I think that's where people are kind of clinging to their, like, distaste or dislike for Dakota. But I think you have to separate the mental abuse with the physical abuse, because there's no excuse to physically abuse someone. There's also no excuse to mentally abuse someone, but you can't just hold one person accountable and not the other. The last comment I will read is from Lauren LaVere, who says, "You really just have to watch the show to see how mentally and emotionally abusive he is." Again, I don't really watch the show, but maybe I will just to get a better understanding. She says, "I think it's a NPD, which is narcissistic personality disorder," I think is what she's alluding to, in Dakota, and a BPD, a bipolar disorder, with Taylor dynamic. And she is physically abusive, and that's not okay. But calling Dakota a victim is not accurate when you see how he treats Taylor. Some examples are intentionally sleeping with her mom's best friend and any new friend Taylor makes. He admitted he does this to upset her. He's the one who sold the footage to TMZ just days before The Bachelorette aired. He's so calculated. We all know he's held that video over her head to stop her from leaving him. She's not perfect, but she's no Jodi Arias, Catherine Knight, etc. Okay, now this comment I really appreciate, because first I'm going to read what I responded, or how I responded, which was to say, I'm not saying that she's comparable to those murders, and I should clarify that. I meant to say that, like, the point is that the double standard is what leads us to cases like this. And often, like, we have to acknowledge that there are female aggressors sometimes. That was my point, is that there's this double standard where the woman is always believed almost until it's too late and the woman has killed somebody. And that's where you see cases like Jodi Arias or Catherine Knight or whoever else. So I wanted to clarify that. But as far as the things that Dakota has done, like sleeping with her mom's best friend, I did not know anything about that. And if that is true, that's so gross. And, you know, if he does sleep with any new friend Taylor makes, then that's also really gross and devastating. But again, like, that's reason enough to just leave somebody and completely cut them off, not to, you know, stay in a relationship with them, keep this on and off cycle, have physical violence on more than one occasion. Like, at some point we have to acknowledge, yeah, that stuff is awful. So why aren't we, you know, holding Taylor accountable for choosing to stay in that cycle? You have to, at some point, take responsibility for your own position in this relationship and either choose to get out of it or acknowledge that you're staying as part of the problem. And maybe that's cold and cynical of me, but you know, I have been in a relationship before where there was one instance of physical abuse and I was the aggressor in that moment. And I won't go into like too many details about it because I don't even know if I should, to be honest, but this was like 25 years ago, probably 20 years ago. And I recognize my fault in that. I should not ever have put my hands on anybody, regardless of what the circumstances were, regardless of if there was alcohol involved. I should not have done that. And I eventually did make the choice to leave that relationship, as hard as it was. And it was really freaking hard. It was really hard. I faced a lot of backlash when I left that relationship, but it's worth it. And so I realize it's scary, but at the same time, like when there are kids involved, especially, you have to get out of it. So I don't know how you find the strength to get out of it, but I just hope she finds it. All right, I'm going to get a sip of water. We're going to take a quick break. If you want to skip this break, you can go to patreon.com/momandmystery and get ad-free episodes and bonus episodes. I will be right back. Before we go on, I want to take a moment to thank the sponsor of today's episode, and that is Time for Learning. Now let's talk about it. Something I know a lot of you have either thought about or you're already doing, homeschooling. And if you're in that season of life where you're craving flexibility, or maybe your child just doesn't thrive in a traditional classroom setting, I want to tell you about Time for Learning. Now, Time for Learning is an all-in-one online curriculum for pre-K through 12th grade. It covers all the core subjects plus electives, basically everything that you could expect from a traditional school, but built for home. And what I love about it is the flexibility. You can mix subjects each day. You can focus on one subject at a time, take learning on the road, or adjust your schedule around your real life, doctor's appointment, travel, just one of those days. You're not locked in to rigid school hours. They even have something called the Cinema Series for middle and high schoolers, which are story-driven, visually engaging courses that feel way more modern and immersive than what most of us grew up with. And for parents, this is huge. They provide transcript templates, grade tracking, and planning tools that align with homeschool requirements in all 50 states. So you're not just winging it and then hoping that you did it right. Because I know that a lot of people who struggle with the idea of homeschooling worry about the fact that they're not competent enough to teach their kids these like intricate lessons, but you don't have to think about all of that. They've been around for over 20 years and have served more than a million students. So this is not just some fly-by-night program. Families actually trust it. If you're curious if Time for Learning is right for your family, visit time4learning.com. That again is time4learning.com to explore their curriculum and find the perfect plan for your student. And you can get started with a monthly subscription to see just how much your kids enjoy learning on their own terms. That's timeforlearning.com.
At Great Wolf Lodge, there's adventure for the whole family. You and your pack can splash away in the indoor water park where it's always 84 degrees. There's a massive wave pool, a lazy river, and tons of water slides for your pack to enjoy together. And the fun doesn't stop there. Get ready to explore and play at adventure-packed attractions from Magi Quest, a live-action game that takes place throughout the lodge to the Northern Lights Arcade. There's also a bunch of great dining options and complimentary daily events like nightly dance parties, all under one roof. And the best part? With 22 lodges across the country, you're always only a short drive away from adventure. So bring your pack together at a lodge near you. Book your stay today at greatwolf.com and strengthen the pack.
All right, our next story comes out of Jupiter Island, Florida, where the golf legend Tiger Woods is back in the headlines after a serious crash near his home, and it quickly turned into a criminal case. Now, according to the Martin County Sheriff's Office, Tiger Woods was involved in a rollover crash on Friday afternoon near Beach Road on Jupiter Island, not far from where he lives. Investigators say Tiger was driving a Land Rover on a narrow two-lane road when he approached a truck that was slowing down to turn into a driveway. Authorities believe Tiger was traveling at a high rate of speed and attempted to pass the truck but clipped the back of its trailer, causing his SUV to flip onto its side and slide across the roadway. Despite how bad that sounds, Tiger was actually able to crawl out of the vehicle through the passenger side, and neither he nor the other driver were injured. But what happened next is what turned this into a bigger situation. Deputies on scene said that Tiger Woods showed signs of impairment, which led him to being taken into custody. He agreed to a breathalyzer test, which showed no alcohol in his system, but refused to take a urine test, which is used to detect drugs or medication. Authorities now believe the possible impairment may have been related to medication or another substance, though that has not officially been confirmed. So he has since been charged with DUI with property damage and refusal to submit to a lawful test. Both of these are considered misdemeanor charges under Florida law. He was taken to the Martin County Jail, where he was required to remain for a minimum holding period before being eligible for release, probably to ensure that he sobered up. This incident is also bringing renewed attention to his history with car-related incidents, including a 2017 DUI arrest and a serious 2021 crash that left him with some serious leg injuries. But what makes the timing even more notable is that the crash happened just days after Tiger Woods returned to competitive golf, raising questions about what comes next for him professionally. So if you watch the body cam footage, it shows him being, as he's being arrested, he's doing these sobriety tests, he's hiccuping through the entire test, and then he turns around and he's being arrested and he's like, "You're gonna arrest me?" And he's completely shocked. And you know, when he's talking, he seems fine, but I guess he failed those sobriety tests. And then the cop is searching his pockets and he's pulling out like his wallet, his AirPods, like a can of those pods, like, you know, chew that you like put in your lip. And then he finally finds in another pocket some pills. And when when the officer pulls them out of his pocket, Tiger says those are Norco, and Norco contains hydrocodone, which is a Schedule II controlled substance. And apparently, as an opioid, Norco exposes the people who use it to the risk of addiction, abuse, and misuse. So I think, you know, just connecting the dots, you might be able to assume that maybe he was under the influence of the hydrocodone. But I'm not saying that as fact. I'm just saying, like, I think you can assume that maybe that's why they believed he was impaired. So yesterday, a judge granted Tiger Woods approval to seek comprehensive inpatient treatment out of the country for the sake of his privacy, where he can hopefully get some help. He has publicly made comments on the crash, saying in a written statement that he understood the seriousness of the situation and that he would be stepping away for a period of time to get treatment. Our next story brings us to Salina, Texas, where an Airbnb mansion party meant for 7 people turned into 800 teenagers, gunshots, and armed threats. So what was supposed to be a small Airbnb booking for just 7 people turned into a massive, like, Project X type of party with reportedly 500 to 800 teenagers and young adults flooding a multi-million dollar mansion after it was promoted on social media. By the time the police got to this house, it had essentially been turned into a huge nightclub. Furniture had been dragged out of the house, fixtures were ripped off the walls, and even a granite kitchen island was broken in half, likely because there were people dancing on it. But here's where it gets even more concerning. Police say they started getting 911 calls about gunshots and reports of armed men at the property. So according to investigators, there were reports of around 10 men at the front gate with weapons who were threatening to kill someone, which immediately escalated the response from officers. At the same time, fights were breaking out inside the party, and witnesses described large brawls and people being dragged across the ground as things spiraled out of control. Then, as the crowd started to scatter, multiple gunshots could be heard, with police later saying at least several rounds were discharged, including shots near the home and even toward a nearby college campus where people had parked. When officers finally cleared the house, they found blood-stained sheets and towels, significant damage throughout the house, evidence of assaults, And despite everything, no gunshot victims were found, which honestly surprised investigators given how chaotic the scene was, but thankfully nobody was injured. The crowd wasn't just local either. Police say people came from Dallas and surrounding areas, turning it into a much bigger situation than just one neighborhood. Two people out of hundreds were arrested at the scene, one for underage DUI and one on an existing aggravated assault warrant. The home itself sits on a massive property estimated around 18 acres and worth several million dollars. And the owner says he was completely blindsided after being told it would just be a small gathering. Now, right now, the investigation is still ongoing as police work to identify who organized the party and whether more charges could be coming. What a nightmare for those homeowners. Now, Sandy Slesser on Facebook said it best with her top comment that says, quote, "And this is why you don't Airbnb a multi-million dollar house," end quote. And I would agree with that. I do see the risk involved in that, although, you know, there are these rules in place where you promise to only bring so many people. And so it's probably hard to, you know, see that coming. Like, who knew? You know, an adult had to be the person that booked it. You can't book an Airbnb under a certain age. So whoever the adult was that booked it will certainly face some consequences and be held responsible. And of course, that also begs the question, how did the party get supplied with the drugs and alcohol that it likely had? Again, there's got to be adults that are responsible here. So I can't believe only two people were arrested. That doesn't make any sense to me. But hopefully, as time goes on and the investigation continues, they figure out who exactly, you know, hosted this party. It reminds me of the Noah Pressgrove case. If you remember, he was the boy who was found on the side of the highway, stripped of his clothes. And this was following a weekend-long party at his friend's house that the parents were kind of hosting. And this is an extreme example, of course, but like obviously these things can happen. And his family is now seeking answers because nobody has been held responsible for his death. So obviously we see these kind of huge parties get taken out of control. And thankfully this is a different, you know, this story has a different ending, but it could have been a lot worse. Now, the next story is out of Coral Springs, Florida, where a community is trying to process what happened after its vice mayor was found dead inside her home, and investigators say it appears to be a domestic violence case. Nancy Mateer Bowen was only 38 years old, and she was the vice mayor of Coral Springs. She was found dead on the morning of April 1st after police were called to her home for a well check. When officers arrived, they discovered her inside of her home. Authorities have not yet released many details about exactly what happened inside the home, but police have confirmed they are investigating her death as an apparent domestic violence incident. Her husband, Stephen Bowen, was quickly identified as a suspect. Investigators say he left the area after the incident, but was later located and taken into custody in a nearby city. Police have said there are no other suspects and that there is no ongoing threat to the public. But beyond that, they've been very careful with the details as the investigation remains active. But what makes this case even heavier is the timing of it all, because just 3 or 4 months earlier, Nancy's younger brother, Donovan Mateer, had died by suicide after a long struggle with mental illness. He was also a survivor of the 2018 Parkland school shooting. So in a matter of months, this family has now experienced 2 devastating losses. Nancy was widely known in her community and beyond. She made history in 2020 as the first Black and Haitian American woman elected to the Coral Springs City Commission, and she was reelected in 2024 before being appointed vice mayor again. Outside of local government, she had also been involved at the national level, working in political organizing and community outreach, and was considered a rising figure in Florida politics. Colleagues described her as someone deeply committed to her community, and officials say her loss leaves a significant void in the city. Our last story is right out of DC, and this is one of those stories that's getting a lot of attention, but the details need to be handled kind of carefully because much of it is based on claims that have not been fully verified, but we're going to talk about it anyway. The reports center on Brian Noem, the husband of former Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem. According to multiple outlets, alleged messages and photos began circulating that appear to show Brian engaging in a private online life involving cross-dressing and interactions with adult content creators. Some of the claims come from individuals who say they communicated with him online over a period of time. One person alleged that he had paid thousands of dollars for conversations and requested specific types of interactions, and that he shared photos of himself dressed in feminine clothing. These details have been widely reported, but they are still based on statements and leaked material rather than anything that has been confirmed through any kind of official investigation. But the pictures are out there. Another part of the story that's been circulating is how the information became public. Some reports suggest that an undocumented individual or someone involved in online sex work may have been connected to the leak. Now, that detail has not been confirmed by authorities and is being reported as a possibility, but not a verified fact. Kristi Noem's team has said that she was unaware of the situation and described herself as blindsided by the reports. The family has asked for privacy as they deal with what comes out. And Brian has not given a full response, but has indicated that he plans to speak publicly at some point. Now, at this point, there are no criminal charges like tied to this situation. It's not really that kind of story. It's more of just like a gossipy trending topic, I guess. But worth noting, Kristi Noem has been rumored to be having an extramarital affair with Corey Lewandowski, who is a longtime political advisor and Trump campaign manager. Those rumors first surfaced around 2021, but really came to a head during a House hearing when Representative Sidney Camlogger Dove, I might be mispronouncing that, but directly asked Kristi about this alleged affair, to which Kristi did not directly answer. So honestly, this seems a lot like something that you would see on the Bravo network. At this point, just get the administration their own show. There's a lot of drama going on with like Summer House, and so maybe they could have their own show that's called The White House, and just, you know, showcase all this drama. And I think the reason people are talking about it, if you're curious, because I have seen some comments that are like, why are we even talking about this? Well, I think the irony of it all is pretty obvious. No matter which side you stand on, unless you're just like super duper far right, then maybe you have a hard time understanding why people are talking about this. But coming from a pretty conservative administration, to have a scandal like this with the pictures of Brian as they are, I mean, How can you not see it? I don't know how else to really break it down for you. If you don't see it, then you just don't see it. But the irony is palpable. Okay, let's just call a spade a spade. All right, now that is it for today's weekly docket. And I hope you guys have a great weekend and a great Easter. And I'll see you again next week for another weekly docket. And until then, be careful, be curious, stay vigilant. Mama Mystery out. Bye.